So look, scientists, historians today are of the opinion that knowledge of the precession of the equinoxes is relatively recent, that we discovered this astronomical phenomenon or observation not much more than 2,000 years ago. But this idea of modern historians, in my opinion, is completely lo wrong, completely wrong, because all over the world, in ancient mythology and ancient texts, we find eerily and mysteriously recurring the same series of numbers and the same images of a gigantic rotating machine, sometimes referred to as a mill, operating in the heavens, which periodically breaks. Now, the precession of the equinoxes is a process that unfolds at the rate of 1 degree every 72 years, and the number 72 is a key indicator of knowledge of precession. And that number may sometimes be divided by 2 to make 36. The 36 may be added to 72 to make 108. The 108 may be divided by 2 to make 54. You have multiples of these numbers. It doesn't matter how many zeros you add on to the end. And you will find in ancient mythology from Scandinavia, from China, from India, from Europe, from all over the world, mythology, which is clearly thousands of years old, the mysterious repetition of these numbers. So, for example, in ancient Egypt, the texts that refer to the god Osiris, tell us that he was killed by 72, conspirators. The Rig Veda, the t fundamental text of ancient India, contains 432,000 syllables. These are all numbers that relate to the precession of the equinoxes. We find references to precession in the Bible, for example, the number 144, which is twice 72. And I need to emphasize that it is not simply me who is saying this. An enormous study was carried out in the 1950s and 1960s by two leading professors of the history of science, Professor Giorgio de Santillana, who was professor of the history of science at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Hertha von Deschend, who was professor of the history of science at the University of Frankfurt. And in their book, Hamlet's Mill, they document in enormous detail the endless detailed recurrence of this sequence of numbers in mythology and ancient texts all over the world. And they reach the conclusion that the only explanation for the presence of these numbers is that, quote unquote, some almost unbelievable ancestor civilization had observed and precisely measured this astronomical process called the precession of the equinoxes, had felt that it was important for mankind to know this, and had encoded it in myths and stories so that it would be passed down by storytellers, generation by generation, for thousands of years, as long as stories continued to be told. And it actually didn't matter whether the storyteller understood that he was relating information about precession or not. All he had to do was tell the story true, and the information would be there. And by the way, it's not only in ancient texts, but it's in ancient monuments as well. For example, the Great Pyramid, if you take its height and multiply it by 432,000, you get the exact measurement of the polar radius of the Earth. And if you measure the base perimeter of the Great Pyramid and multiply it by 432,000, you get the exact measurement of the equatorial circumference of the Earth. This cannot be a coincidence because of the scale used, 1 to 432,000. This is one of those numbers that are related in mythology and texts all over the world to the precession of the equinoxes. One of the mysteries that has concerned me in my research is the astonishing similarity of themes and information in myths and traditions from all over the world. For example, it is really quite surprising to find in the mythologies of many different cultures, from the ancient Maya to the ancient Egyptians to the ancient Indians, the notion that the gods came down from heaven to earth, came from the stars, if you like, and sometimes even from specific star systems, such as the constellation of Orion or the Pleiades, and that they brought wisdom to earth. The only conclusion I can come to is that all of these similar myths share a remote common ancestor, that at some time deep in prehistory there was a diffusion of ideas all around the world, and that this was a deliberate process designed to present information to the future and to preserve that information in a very clever way by encoding it in wonderful stories that people would want to go on telling to each other down the generations. And as a result, even today, thousands of years later, we find these similarities in the DNA of myths and traditions all around the world. The date of 10,500 BC, roughly give or take 50 or 100 years, that's 12,500 years ago, is a date that has come up again and again in my research. It comes up fundamentally in the architecture of the gigantic and mysterious monuments of the Giza Plateau in Egypt, by which I mean the three great pyramids and the great Sphinx of Egypt. These monuments appear to have been laid out on the ground in relation to the River Nile to capture or freeze or preserve or memorialize a specific moment in time. Because of the phenomenon of the precession of the equinoxes, the stars in the sky change their positions very, very slowly down the years. This is actually not because of the movements of the stars themselves, but because of the movements of our planet, planet Earth. Planet Earth is the platform from which we observe the stars, and there is a slow wobble on the axis of the Earth, rather like the kind of wobble that occurs when a top is set spinning and begins to slow down. And that wobble on the axis of the Earth changes our orientation in relation to the stars at particular times of year, very, very slowly over a 26,000 year cycle. So, for example, if you imagine the extended North Pole of the Earth, presently in our time, it points to the star Polaris, that is our pole star. But in the past, because of the precession, the pole star has been other than Polaris. Sometimes the North Pole of the Earth has pointed at empty space, and sometimes it has pointed at different stars as it performs a great circle in the heavens, taking just under 26,000 years to complete. And this also affects the familiar constellations of the zodiac, the 12 constellations of the zodiac, and their relationship to the rising sun at the spring equinox every year, the time when night and day are of exactly equal length, which is the 21st of March in the Northern Hemisphere. That's why we talk about, for example, we live in the dawning of the age of Aquarius. What that means is that in our age, if you stand an hour before dawn, on the 21st of March and look perfectly due east, where the sun will rise on that day. But before the sun rises, you will see that the constellations of Pisces and Aquarius are lying on the horizon in the direction that you're looking. And what's happening is that they're rotating around in relation to the rising point of the sun. And for the last 2,000 years, the sun has been rising in Pisces, but it's now moving into the constellation of Aquarius. And that's what that song means. We live in the dawning of the age of Aquarius. If you were to go back thousands of years, you would find that there was a period roughly from 4000 BC to 2000 BC when the sun rose in the constellation of Taurus, the bull, on the spring equinox. And after that, it was in the constellation of Aries, the ram, from 2000 BC to the time of Christ. And then from the time of Christ to the present day, as I say, it's been in the constellation of Pisces, the fish, and it's about to move into Aquarius. Not only the zodiacal constellations, but the exact position and orientation of all the other stars in the sky is also affected by this phenomenon called precession of the equinoxes. Now, I need to tell you this so that you understand what I'm going to say about the Giza Plateau. It has been well established by my colleague, the engineer and archaeoastronomer Robert Boval, in his book, The Orion Mystery, that there is an astonishing resemblance between the pattern of the three great pyramids on the ground at Giza and the pattern of the three stars of Orion's belt. And we need to understand immediately that the constellation of Orion was not just any old constellation to the ancient Egyptians. It was actually the most important constellation in the sky. And when they looked at the constellation of Orion, they saw it as the figure of their god, Osiris. So this constellation was extremely important to the ancient Egyptians. And there are many references in ancient Egyptian texts, the pyramid texts, the Book of the Dead, and so on, which speak of the need, a mysterious need, to copy on the ground the patterns of the stars in the sky, and which tell us that a great secret is hidden in the sky, in the hidden circle of the sky. Now, what's interesting is that not only do the three stars of Orion's belt, do the three pyramids represent, obviously it's immediately obvious to the naked eye, anybody can see it, that the three pyramids have a pattern that's very similar to the pattern of the three stars of Orion's belt, and this is true in any age. But if you go back in time, and we can do this with modern computer software, there's excellent software now, which incorporates all the movements of the precession of the equinoxes, and we have the privilege today on our computers of being able to see any sky at any time during the past 30,000 years over any point in the Earth's surface. And so if you set your computer software to Giza and start winding back the skies, you'll find that changes take place in the orientation of the constellation of Orion until you get to 10,500 BC, 12,500 years ago. And then the obvious resemblance of the three belt stars to the three pyramids becomes perfect. Absolutely a perfect lock between sky and ground at dawn on the spring equinox in 10,500 BC. At exactly the same moment, the constellation of Leo, the lion, is rising directly in front of the gaze of the Great Sphinx, which of course is a lion-bodied monument, and we believe originally a lion-headed monument as well. What happened was that later pharaohs who found this ancient monument simply recarved that lion's head into a human head, but originally it was entirely a lion. So we have a lion monument carved out of solid rock, gazing at its own image in the sky at dawn on the spring equinox in 10,500 BC. And at exactly the same moment, we have the three great pyramids on the ground laid out in exactly the pattern of the three stars of Orion's belt at the same date, 10,500 BC. And furthermore, the river Nile matches exactly the position of the Milky Way at that moment in time, 12,500 years ago. Now, I'm not suggesting that whoever created the Giza complex also put the river Nile there. The river Nile was there already, but that site was chosen because of the orientation of the river Nile at that time. It made a perfect site to create this diagram on the ground. And unless it, in case it seems odd to you that an ancient culture should choose to memorialize a date using monumental architecture, be aware that we do the same thing today in our culture. For example, the Hoover Dam in the United States incorporates a gigantic star map in its architecture. And that star map freezes the positions of the stars in the sky over the Hoover Dam at the moment the Hoover Dam was completed. And this was done, the architect and artist who were involved tell us, so that at some future time, perhaps in 10,000 years from now, if our language has been completely lost and there's no way of communicating with our texts, that by reference to that star map, a future civilization would be able to work out exactly when the Hoover Dam was created. So this idea is not an extraordinary idea, but what's extraordinary is that we find it memorializing the date of 10,500 BC at Giza. And furthermore, we find something else that Professor Robert Schock of Boston University and John Anthony West have demonstrated, I think conclusively, that the erosion patterns on the body of the Great Sphinx are the result of exposure to thousands of years of extremely heavy rainfall. And such rainfall has never fallen in Egypt in the last 5,000 years. You have to go back thousands of years before that to get the very heavy rains that took place at the end of the last ice age, which would have been capable of causing that kind of erosion on the Sphinx. So suddenly we have astronomy broadcasting very loudly to us the message that this site speaks of the date of 12,500 years ago, which we call 10,500 BC, and that the geology of the site and the geology of the Great Sphinx also speaks of that date, that it tells us that this monument was not created by the pharaohs, but was standing there thousands of years before, rather than the time of the end of the last ice age. And lastly, it's important to realize that 10,500 BC, 12,500 years ago, is indeed in the middle of one of those great episodes of flooding that occurred at the end of the last ice age, when the huge ice sheets that covered most of Northern Europe and most of North America were melting down and sea level was rising. My view is that the date of 10,500 BC memorialized, for example, in the architecture of the Giza Plateau, marks a very significant moment. And I would say that what it marks is the end of a global cataclysm that wiped out a high civilization of antiquity, completely wiped it from the face of the earth. Nobody today can really imagine what it was like at the end of the last ice age. But let's get this clear. 120 meter rise in sea level all around the world. Gigantic ice sheets collapsing, huge floods racing across the land, scouring out the landscape, wiping everything clear, pouring into the world ocean and raising sea level very, very dramatically. More than 27 million square kilometers of land went under the water at that time. That's roughly the size of Europe and China added together. It's an enormous amount of land that's just been wiped from the record, is all under the sea today, and therefore out of our view. I believe that the cataclysm was so immense that destroyed a high civilization of antiquity and virtually wiped the memories of mankind. We became a species with amnesia. But there were survivors of that cataclysm, and they settled in a number of locations around the world, key locations. One of those locations was Giza in Egypt. Another was Central America, the area of the Maya, the Yucatan. In Mexico. Another, I believe, was India. And in these locations, they established or tried to re-establish their system. And first of all, they memorialized the end of their civilization by telling us this was the time when it stopped and the new beginning started. And secondly, they tried to pass down what knowledge they could. I envisaged institutions, something like monasteries, which were established in these different locations, and which then recruited from the local population, so that within one or two generations, everybody who was within those institutions was a member of the local population, not a settler from a lost civilization, but nevertheless preserving and passing down the knowledge of the lost civilization. And at a certain point, in the case of ancient Egypt, around 3000 BC, they decided to switch on civilization again and to incorporate all the knowledge from the past. That's why ancient Egypt seems perfect at the beginning and only deteriorates from there. Normally, we would expect to see a culture slowly rise, but ancient Egypt, historical culture appears just out of nowhere, like a complete miracle, fully formed, capable of the most extraordinary architectural feats. And the only explanation I can give you for that is that that knowledge was preserved and passed down over thousands of years, ultimately from a lost civilization of antiquity. So for me, the date of 10,500 BC marks the time when the cataclysm was over and the world was to start again. And we are now 12,500 years later, still trying to recover our memories and still trying to figure out which way we go forward from here. If we're going to figure that out, we need to refer to the ancient wisdoms. Well, I guess everyone wants to know what was the purpose of the Great Pyramids of Giza. The Great Pyramid itself is the last surviving wonder of the ancient world, an incredible atmosphere of mystery and intrigue surrounds it. And as a matter of fact, when I first met the Great Pyramid, which was in 1989, I was completely dumbfounded by what I saw. I just couldn't believe my eyes. And that sense of the magic and mystery of the Great Pyramid has remained with me down all the years since that first encounter. And I've been privileged to visit Egypt probably more than 100 times, and to climb the Great Pyramid five times. I've five times stood on the top of the Great Pyramid and felt its amazing power. This monument seems to vibrate with energy as you stand on top of it. You sense that you're in a very magical and unique place in the earth. And the mere statistics alone are enough to make you wonder what is going on here. This monument weighs 6 million tons. It has a footprint of more than 13 acres. It's 481 feet high. It consists of more than 2.5 million blocks of stone. Some of those blocks of stone weigh as much as 70 tons each, 70 tons. Raised to heights of hundreds of feet above the ground. You know, clearly we're dealing with the work that comes close to magic, where science and magic join together. Those who created the Great Pyramid definitely knew things that we do not know today. It would be extremely difficult for us, even with the most modern technology, to reproduce the Great Pyramid in the perfection that we find it today at Giza. And yet it's supposed to be one of the very first monuments ever created by the ancient Egyptians. How do we explain this? It's truly a gigantic mystery. And it's not just the size of the Great Pyramid, it's the astonishing precision of the Great Pyramid. The Great Pyramid is aligned to within 3/60ths of a single degree perfectly to true north. The error is tiny. It's the kind of error that we would associate with advanced GPS measurements today. So it's astonishing to find it in this ancient monument. And that ancient monument, the Great Pyramid, is part of a complex that consists of two other large pyramids, a number of satellite pyramids, the Great Sphinx, And of course, huge megalithic temples, which are called the mortuary temples and the valley temples, that are found around the Giza Plateau, in some cases containing blocks of stone that weigh up to 200 tons each. Clearly, there's something very special going on at Giza. And I would suggest that these monuments have more than one function. I don't think that it's enough to say, as the Egyptologists do and keep repeating to us, that these monuments were the tombs of pharaohs. Actually, there's no evidence whatsoever that these monuments were the tombs of pharaohs. Not a single pharaonic burial has ever been found inside any of them. There are no inscriptions inside any of them which tell us that this or that is the tomb of this or that pharaoh. They're completely anonymous and silent. We have to deduce their purpose from studying the monuments directly and letting the monuments speak to us. One thing is clear, they have a spiritual purpose. The ancient Egyptian religion, which I believe was inherited from a lost civilization, focuses very much on the mystery of life and death. Today in our civilization, we hardly ask any questions about these matters. There's an assumption by materialist scientists that when we die, we're dead, and that's the end of the story. We're just matter, and when the matter dies, we're finished. That is the unproven assumption of materialist science. There is actually no evidence for that assumption. It's a kind of religious belief on the part of scientists that there is no life after death. No scientist has actually been there and come back and said, oh, I went there and I found no life after death. It's not based on observation. It's not based on empirical evidence. It's simply an opinion of science which has been foisted on the public. And because we have respect for science, many members of the public believe it. When it comes to the issue of life after death, I would rather listen to the masters of the field. The ancient Egyptians devoted their best minds for 3,000 years to considering no other mystery than this: what happens to us when we die? And in their view, what happens to us when we die is that we go on, that consciousness does not die, that it continues on after death, and that everything we do in this life is our opportunity to prepare for that moment. We should not waste the gift of life. We should learn and grow and develop from our presence in this body, in this life. And I believe that we cannot separate the Great Pyramids of Egypt from this profound and deeply thought out religious idea. They were part of a system designed to secure the perfection of the soul. This was a notion that was very clear in the ancient Egyptian texts, that we should seek to perfect our souls during this life, not to perfect our material wealth, not to surround ourselves with things and objects, not to put on a panoply of display and power. What we are here to do in this life is to grow and develop our soul. And I believe very strongly that the Great Pyramids were connected to this. If you're lucky enough to find yourself completely alone in the Great Pyramid, rather than with a group of 150 tourists, you'll begin to gather what I mean. A kind of silence descends. It's as though there's a spirit in the walls of the Great Pyramid that hides when there are too many people around, but that comes out and speaks to you directly when you're alone there. And even better, if you're lucky enough to be there when the electricity is cut and you find yourself in complete darkness, in this gigantic, echoing, 6 million ton perfect monument, in its narrow corridors and passageways, its pitfalls, its mysterious chambers. Find your way around that monument in the dark, as I believe the ancient initiates did. Allow the sensory deprivation to work on you, and you will begin to feel a connection with the world beyond. And that connection is nourishing, and it tells us very clearly that there's much more to this life than just our material bodies. I think the Great Pyramid was used as a place of initiation. I do envisage the pharaohs and those before them placed inside it in total darkness to overcome their fears and to allow the monument to speak to them directly. It's a kind of process of transmutation that takes place. And I think we would be wrong to separate the pyramids from that spiritual objective. But interestingly, there are many technical elements in the Great Pyramid as well, just the sheer wonder of the architecture and the astronomical and mathematical and geometrical elements of the Great Pyramid. These require us, if we wish to understand them, to initiate ourselves in those systems of knowledge. When I first came to the Great Pyramid, I was completely ignorant of astronomy and mathematics. But in order to understand the Great Pyramid and get to grips with it, I had to teach myself these subjects. I had to start learning about them. It forced me to initiate myself, and it set me on a process of learning that has helped me to grow and develop. And as a matter of fact, when people come to the Great Pyramid and are confronted by it, well, some of those people think it's just a heap of stones. But others are touched and deeply moved by these monuments. I would say the majority of people are touched and deeply moved. And in every one of them, it sets off a process of self-inquiry, which, if they follow it through to fruition, will make them better people than they were when they began. It's not an easy process. Making oneself a better person is very hard work and requires overcoming a lifetime of bad habits. But the Great Pyramids do help to set us on that road to self-inquiry. And I'm not saying that I've got there yet. I'm still a beginner on that road. But I'm grateful to the Great Pyramid for opening my mind to extraordinary possibilities and allowing me to begin in a very amateurish way to start off the learning process that was used in ancient times with the high initiates of antiquity. I'm against the idea that the Great Pyramid is some kind of machine for generating power or whatever. I think that oversimplifies the amazing perfection of the monument. I think it is fundamentally about the growth and development of the human soul. But nevertheless, it's quite likely also that the energetic powers of the Great Pyramid, which are well documented, were a further function of this monument, that it sits on top of a power point on the earth, and that the health of the whole land around it is in some way protected by this monument. So although I resist a notion that this is purely a technological monument, I don't deny that there is a possibility that it does have some technological functions. The heart of the mystery of the Great Pyramid, for me, is the so-called sarcophagus, the granite sarcophagus, in the so-called King's Chamber, because we do not know what these rooms were called in ancient times. There's no evidence whatsoever that this quote-unquote sarcophagus was used for the burial of any pharaoh. I believe that it was used in a profound process of initiation, which allowed the initiate almost to experience death and to experience the life that we will find ourselves in after death. The ancient Egyptians believed that after death, the soul must make a journey through a strange parallel universe that they called the Duat. And this was at once a region of the sky and also a mysterious underworld with narrow corridors and passageways and chambers. And when you look on some of the later tombs, for example, the tomb of Thutmosis III in the Valley of the Kings, you can see around the walls images of what the ancient Egyptians thought the Duat looked like, this afterlife kingdom. And what it looks like is astonishingly like the interior of the Great Pyramid, with narrow corridors and passageways in which you're forced to double over, huge galleries that that suddenly open up, leading up at a slope, and strange and mysterious chambers. These are the features of the Duat, as it was envisaged by the ancient Egyptians, and they are the features of the Great Pyramid. And in order to enter and explore the Duat, we must die. And I believe what the ancient Egyptians did was they found a way, inherited from a lost civilization, a system of knowledge, which allowed them to experience death without dying. And that the sarcophagus was used as part of this process. Firstly, the initiate would be placed in total darkness inside the Great Pyramid, complete sensory deprivation. Sensory deprivation is known to be one of the necessary conditions for bringing on visionary experience. Once you cut out the external world, the mind is able to reach frequencies and levels that it is not normally able to reach, because we're so focused in our daily life on the problems and hassles and the sheer noise of the physical realm in which we exist, that we have very little time to experience and explore spiritual realms which surround us all the time but which are not normally accessible to our senses. So the first step is to put the initiate in a state of acute sensory deprivation. Secondly, it's clear that the ancient Egyptians used visionary plants, most notably the blue water lily, Cerulea nymphaea, which is now well established to be a visionary plant, what we would call a hallucinogen, except I reject the whole notion of hallucinations. What is happening when we experience visions is poorly understood by science. It may be that the brain does not generate consciousness, but that receives consciousness, and that in an altered state of consciousness, whole areas of reality that are not normally accessible to our senses become accessible. I think this is what the Great Pyramid was about, with initiates who may first have taken the blue water lily, and we see many representations in ancient Egyptian art of the blue water lily and its association with rebirth and with the afterlife. And in this state of enhanced susceptibility to visions, of awareness of the spiritual world that lies around and interpenetrates the material world, in this state the initiate would be placed in the so-called sarcophagus in the king's chamber. I myself have had the privilege to lie down in this sarcophagus many times. And again, it's most important, if you really want to experience its effect, to be able to do that when there's nobody else in the pyramid at all, just you, alone, in that sarcophagus. If you then begin to chant, just to utter any sound, the whole atmosphere inside the sarcophagus changes. It begins to vibrate. You feel a vibration moving down through your body as though it's activating energy centers in the body, making you aware of things you had not been aware of before. Let two or three other people come into the king's chamber and it all goes away and vanishes. But be there alone and you can experience the incredible transformative power of this so-called sarcophagus. So I think it's about enhancing the visionary capacities of humanity to allow us to see that which is normally unseen, to allow us to understand directly that there is much more to life than just these physical bodies, that we are fundamentally spiritual beings in physical bodies. We are souls who have a body, not bodies who have a soul. And as souls, we need to learn and grow and develop. And the Great Pyramid and the experiences that unfold within that sarcophagus are a key part of this process. My best guess, after having had the privilege of spending more than 20 years studying the monuments of the Giza Plateau, is that that these monuments were built in two distinct phases. and that we cannot separate them off completely from the pharaohs of Egypt. The pharaohs of Egypt were involved in this project, and the survivors of a lost civilization were also involved in this project thousands of years earlier. So first of all, let's take the monuments that in my view are clearly much older than the time of the pharaohs. And those monuments include the Great Sphinx itself, carved out of solid rock and bearing the evidence of exposure to thousands of years of heavy rainfall, which tells us immediately geologically, this work has been supported by Professor Robert Schock of Boston University, that the Great Sphinx is much older than the date given to it by Egyptologists. Egyptologists say it dates from 2500 BC, that's 4,500 years ago, but the geology says that the Great Sphinx is thousands of years older than that. At the same time that the Great Sphinx was carved out of the solid bedrock, the rock that was removed from around its core body in order to create the body was put together into huge temples that stand in front of the Great Sphinx, the so-called Sphinx Temple and the Valley Temple. And in the case of these two temples, there are blocks of stone that weigh up to 100 tons each. They were definitely made at the same time that the Sphinx was made. Therefore, if the Sphinx dates back to 10,500 BC, as we think it does, so also do those megalithic temples in front of it. I think that the base of the Great Pyramid, you have to understand that the Great Pyramid is actually built around a natural hill. And that natural hill is about 30 feet high, not very high. It's more of a mound. And there are many references to a primeval mound in the ancient Egyptian texts. And quarried into that mound is a passageway which descends down into the bowels of the earth and today lies 100 feet directly beneath the base of the Great Pyramid. That's the so-called subterranean chamber of the Great Pyramid. I think it was also created in around 10,500 BC by the survivors of a lost civilization. And I would suggest that the base courses of the Great Pyramid and the first courses of the second and third pyramid were also created in that period. And then that period of construction came to an end, and the knowledge that was involved in it retreated within an institution, something like a monastery, and was preserved for thousands and thousands of years until those initiates felt that the time had come to switch on a new civilization. And that happened around 3000 BC with the switching on, the sudden and mysterious switching on of the ancient Egyptian civilization, which I regard as a direct descendant in terms of its knowledge and ideas of the lost civilization that established itself there in 10,500 BC. So it's interesting that in the pattern of the three great pyramids on the ground and their relationship to the Sphinx, we find clear astronomical references to the date of 10,500 BC. They have frozen the stars of Orion's belt as they looked in 10,500 BC, and they have frozen the constellation of Leo in the form of the Sphinx as it looked in 10,500 BC. But within the Great Pyramid itself, we have four mysterious shafts. These shafts go through the body of the pyramid. Two of them emanate from the so-called King's Chamber, and they actually go all the way through the body of the pyramid, and they emerge on the south and north faces of the Great Pyramid. And you can roll a ball down them from the outside, and that ball will appear inside the King's Chamber. In the lower chamber, the one that Egyptologists refer to as the Queen's Chamber, there are also two shafts. These shafts were actually covered with stone blocks. Their entrance was covered with stone blocks until the year 1872, when a British Freemason called Wainman Dixon, who'd noticed the shafts in the King's Chamber, thought there might be shafts in the Queen's Chamber as well. And he went around knocking on the walls of the Queen's Chamber, and he found two hollow points, and he got out his hammer and chisel and broke away the stone, which there was only about that thick, and lo and behold, he revealed the openings of two hidden shafts. And these shafts do not emerge on the outside of the Great Pyramid. They end somewhere within the Great Pyramid. And in recent years, some exploration of them has been done with robot cameras. The shafts are very narrow. They're only about that wide and that high. So obviously you can't get a human being into them, but they do invite exploration. And when they've been explored, what we found is that there's a doorway at the end of each shaft. And these doorways have got two metal handles. And when the researchers have drilled a hole through the doorways with their robot, they have found a gap and then another doorway, which presently resists, technically resists further investigation. A new robot will have to be designed in order to drill through that other doorway. So we have these shafts, and what's interesting is that all four shafts point at four stars in the positions that they occupied, not in 10,500 BC, but in 2,500 BC, the time of the pharaohs of Egypt. So, for example, the southern shaft of the Queen's Chamber points at the star Sirius in its position in 2,500 BC. And the star Sirius was extremely important to the ancient Egyptians. It was the goddess Isis. And the southern shaft of the King's Chamber points at the lowest of the three stars of the belt of the constellation of Orion, which the ancient Egyptians associated with the god Osiris, the consort, the husband of Isis. So this cannot be an accident. And the same goes for the northern shafts, which target circumpolar stars in the constellations of Draco and of Ursa Minor. It's a lock, very clearly. They're saying this monument has something to do with 2,500 BC, but also in its layout on the ground, it has something to do with 10,500 BC. And from this I deduce that we're looking at a very long-term project that was begun in 10,500 BC, went into a long period of hibernation, and then was renewed and completed in 2,500 BC at the time of the pharaohs, and that in doing this, the pharaohs were directly continuing the system of knowledge of a lost civilization. I would say that not just under and around the Great Sphinx, but all over the Giza Plateau and amongst its incredible monuments, there are hidden and as yet undiscovered or unexplored features. We know for sure that there is a large chamber under the Great Sphinx at a depth of about 20 feet beneath the left forepaw. And we know this as a result of the seismic survey work that was carried out in the early 1990s by Professor Robert Schock of Boston University and John Anthony West. They used seismic equipment to measure sound waves sent under the earth and very clearly demonstrated the existence of a large chamber under the left forepaw of the Sphinx. As soon as this was discovered, their work was interrupted and stopped by the Egyptian authorities, and no further work has been allowed at the site. Whenever we press the Egyptian authorities to explore this chamber under the Great Sphinx, they say, no, we're not prepared to do that because it might damage the Great Sphinx. And that's understandable. We don't want to damage the Great Sphinx. But there are, with modern technology, very subtle ways, using fiber optic camera to drill down and insert a camera into that chamber and see what's going on there. And I do find it odd that the Egyptian authorities up till now and the whole Egyptological establishment have resisted the exploration of this chamber, because there are accounts from a number of different sources that suggest that something very interesting may be hidden in that chamber. First of all, the ancient Egyptians themselves referred to what they called the Books of Thoth. Thoth was the ancient Egyptian god of wisdom, the supposed inventor of writing, who later became associated with the Greek god Hermes, and even later with the Roman god Mercury. The Books of Thoth are referred to as being hidden in a secret chamber in many ancient Egyptian texts, and these texts tell us very specifically that that chamber is somewhere on the Giza Plateau. I think that that chamber that's been identified but not yet explored beneath the Great Sphinx may well be the chamber that is referred to in those ancient texts and that hold these books of wisdom the wisdom of the gods. From a completely different source, a more modern source, the American psychic Edgar Cayce, who was fundamentally a healer. Edgar Cayce used to put himself into a trance, and in the trance state he would be able to diagnose the illness of his patient and to propose a remedy, and he was an enormously successful healer. But he also said other things when he was in a trance, and specifically he remembered past lives, going back to the time of the lost civilization of Atlantis. Now, of course, I understand that modern scientists reject any notion of past lives, and whenever we talk about psychics, they roll their eyes and claim that we're mad. But nevertheless, the information that Edgar Cayce brought to this subject is extremely interesting. He said, long before the seismic survey work was done in the 1990s, he said this back in the 1940s, that a chamber would be found beneath the left forepaw of the Sphinx. And what he said was that that chamber contains the Hall of Records of Atlantis, all the records of a lost civilization, all their science, all their spiritual knowledge, everything preserved there, like a time capsule, to be rediscovered in our time today. And were it Edgar Cayce alone, I would place less weight on it. But once we also take into account the ancient tradition, the ancient Egyptian traditions of the books of Thoth hidden in a chamber at Giza, I think we need to take this very, very seriously. I would suggest that a lost chapter of the history of mankind and all the evidence for it will be found in that chamber, and that that knowledge of that lost civilization may be precisely what we need today in order to recover our memory and move forward again on the true path of mankind. Because one thing's for sure, today we are lost. The human race is lost. We do not know where we are going. We do not know what our mission here is, and we need to rediscover it, and with the help of the ancients we may be able to do so. So yes, under the Great Sphinx, definitely a chamber, and very interesting possibilities as to what that chamber may contain. But let's not confine ourselves to that. I think the whole of the Giza Plateau, and again there's some seismic evidence for this, sits on top of a labyrinth of underground corridors and passageways, and that within the Great Pyramid itself, down in the subterranean chamber, we just see one part of this labyrinth, that it continues underneath the whole of the Giza Plateau. And lastly, that there are almost certainly hidden chambers within the Great Pyramid itself. Those mysterious shafts from the Queen's Chamber, the south and north shafts that end with little doors, which are followed by a space and yet another door that has not yet been opened, suggest to me very strongly that there may be other chambers inside the Great Pyramid. And we are going to have to work very hard in order to find and explore those chambers. But mysteriously, it seems that certain forces are at work in the world of Egyptology, in the world of officialdom, that do not want us to make those discoveries. I think this is a crucial issue for mankind. We need to recover our memory. We cannot be prevented from doing so by arrogant bureaucrats who may indeed have a dark purpose for mankind. We need to recover our memory, and the keys to our memory lie at Giza. For me, the planet Mars and the possible existence on the surface of the planet Mars of artificial structures is a great mystery which requires further investigations. I don't have strong beliefs on this subject. I don't insist that there is any artificial structure on the surface of Mars, but I suggest that there is an invitation to investigate further there, particularly in the area known as Cydonia, where we have a number of pyramid-like structures and the famous face on Mars, which NASA has repeatedly insisted is not a face, but is just a natural structure, as they also insist with the so-called pyramids of Cydonia. My friend Richard Hoagland has done a huge amount of work on those structures and has found astonishing geometrical relationships connecting them, which would be most surprising if they were natural, but which makes sense if they're artificial. So in my own work on this subject, what I've tried to do is to draw attention to this area and to raise simply the possibility that there are artificial structures there. I don't insist that they're artificial, but I think they're intriguing enough to require detailed further research rather than the simple dismissals and propaganda that we get from NASA. Because my goodness, if there are artificial structures on Mars, then everything we think about our place in the universe and the solar system changes. It's such a big issue, the stakes are very, very high, that surely it's worth spending a bit of time and money investigating this further. I would say we'll never get the final solution to this problem with photographs taken from space. It'll only be when we put manned missions on Mars that it will be possible to determine absolutely whether these are natural or man or artificial structures. I'm not saying man-made structures, because we don't know who made them, if they're structures at all. But what disturbs me is the way that the scientific community simply dismisses this as irrelevant, and just seems to be obvious to them that these are natural structures when they have many intriguing geometrical features and interrelationships. I suggest we have a mystery here. We need to investigate it with an open mind. And that's been the hallmark of all my work, to keep an open mind, to not reach closed and firm conclusions about mysteries. And I feel very strongly that there is a great mystery on the planet Mars. When it comes to the subject of Mars, I don't have beliefs. I have curiosity. And I feel that there are enough mysterious and intriguing features on the surface of the planet Mars to arouse the curiosity of any reasonable person. If the pyramids and the face on Mars that we find in the region of Cydonia are artificial structures, then we have to ask ourselves, when were they made, and what do they represent, and what happened to whoever or whatever made them? And the one thing that I think I've demonstrated quite conclusively in my work on this subject is that the planet Mars was subjected to a gigantic cataclysm. It was hit by what appears to be the fragments of an exploded comet, much as we saw the comet Shoemaker-Levy break up into multiple warheads and hit the planet Jupiter some years ago. A similar cataclysm. Of course, the planet Jupiter is so large that it can absorb many such impacts, but Mars is much smaller. And a similar cataclysm occurred on Mars, so that one half of Mars is a kilometer higher than the other half. It's as though the whole outer surface of half of the planet Mars was just blasted away by huge cosmic impacts. And the evidence that I have explored suggests that this cataclysm on Mars occurred relatively recently, within the last 20,000 years, exactly the same time that we also had the cataclysm of the end of the last ice age on Earth. And given the undoubted cataclysmic history of the planet Mars, but this was a planet that once had water, it may have been fertile, it may have been an excellent home for life, and then it was struck by this gigantic bombardment of an exploding, fragmenting comet and was just literally destroyed overnight. Given that cataclysmic history, I don't think we should rule out anything until we've been there and explored that planet. It may be that there is much more than evidence for just very simple life forms on Mars. It may be that there was a whole civilization there, and it may even be that that civilization was in some way connected with a lost civilization on Earth. But beyond that, I will not go in speculation, and it's all speculation until we actually get to Mars, physically put boots on the planet, and explore the mysterious features of that planet. I call us species with amnesia, because I think we've lost our memory of an entire episode of human history, just being wiped completely from our memories. And until we recover our memory of that lost episode of human civilization, we will not be complete ourselves. We need to know who we are and where we came from. The way I look at this problem, I think it's intimately associated with the cataclysmic end of the last ice age between 20,000 and 10,000 years ago. The huge rise in sea level, 120-meter rise in sea level, the meltdown of the gigantic ice caps. These were cataclysms beyond the scale of any imagining today. No natural disaster that occurs today is in any way comparable to the huge series of global cataclysms that brought the last ice age to the end. And the areas of the Earth that were most severely affected by those cataclysms were along the coastlines of the existing continents. I would suggest that the lost civilization was a maritime, seagoing civilization that lived primarily off the resources of the sea and that occupied the best lands on Earth during the last ice age, the lands along the coasts. Unfortunately, it was those very lands along the coastlines that were flooded cataclysmically at the end of the last ice age, thus wiping out that civilization. Now, many might wonder, if this was a high-tech civilization, how come it wasn't able to predict the disaster? How come it wasn't able to survive intact through the disaster? I suggest there were survivors, but relatively few, who settled and restarted civilization at various points around the world, but I suggest that the civilization itself was destroyed. My view is that its technology wasn't actually that high tech. I think the technology of the lost civilization was roughly equivalent to our technology in the 19th or late 18th century. This was a civilization that was capable of exploring the whole world and of mapping it very accurately. And I say that because many ancient maps have come down to us. In every case, these maps are the latest copies of earlier source maps that have now been lost. And these maps show us the world not as it looks today or as it looked when the last copies were made in the 15th and 16th centuries, but as it looked during the last ice age, as it looked more than 12,000 years ago. So I think we had a civilization that was capable of mapping accurately and exploring the whole world. But the level of technology required to do that is not astrophysics. The level of technology required to do that is more like our technology at the beginning of the 19th century or the end of the 18th century. I actually don't think that the lost civilization was that interested in technology. That's our obsession today. We think technology is the answer to everything. I think what the lost civilization has to teach us is spiritual knowledge. I think their primary focus was on the spiritual dimension of mankind and on the perfection of the soul. And I think that quite a lot of their technological achievements, the ones that really baffle us today, the ones that we can't reproduce, for example, lifting those huge blocks of stone up to hundreds of feet above the ground, I think that that those so-called technological achievements are likely to have been the result of focusing of the powers of the mind. This is something we don't do today. We think that everything has to be reduced to mechanical advantage. We always look for mechanical solutions to problems, and we think that's the only way to go. What we've neglected is the power of the human mind and of focused will and intent. I would suggest that the lost civilization had developed the powers of the human mind to a very high level, and that ancient accounts, for example, of the levitation of huge stone blocks using sound, using groups of priests singing and making a particular tone, and the giant block rising into the air, are probably true. And that that is the kind of technology, quote-unquote, that the lost civilization sought, a spiritual technology based on mental and psychic powers rather than a mechanical technology of the kind that that we have today. And their technology ultimately was not enough to save them from the massive cataclysm at the end of the last ice age. But what they did save was their focus on the spiritual dimension of life and the fact that this is something that we as human beings need to pay attention to. We are not paying attention to the spiritual dimension of life in the 21st century world. The sickness of industrial and technological society is that we have severed our connection with spirit. If we do not reconnect with spirit, we will bring the whole of our civilization crashing down in ruins around us. We don't even need a geological cataclysm to bring it about. We're going to do it ourselves. Right now, we are set on a suicidal path as a culture. Unless we wake up to who and what we really are, we are going to inflict that suicide on the whole world. And if we're going to wake up to who and what we really are, we need to discover where we came from. We need to recover our memories. We need to know that before us were others who also rose high and fell, but who sought to preserve the most important part of ourselves, which is the spiritual quest. So what happened to the lost civilization, and why have we not found more traces of it? The answer lies in the gigantic cataclysm at the end of the last ice age, a cataclysm that is just beyond all imagining today. We experience tsunamis today and they plunge us into chaos. We experience hurricanes like Hurricane Katrina and they cause massive disruption. But they're just tiny, tiny, tiny compared with what happened to the Earth at the end of the last ice age. You're looking at, you know, thousands of years of continuous cataclysms. And in those cataclysms, the key effect was the rise of sea levels by 120 meters. And that's the first place we need to look. We need to be looking in the places we're not looking now for the remains of the lost civilization. We need to be looking underwater. I personally spent close to 7 years scuba diving all around the world looking for underwater ruins and finding them, which were documented in my books and also in a television series called Flooded Kingdoms of the Ice Age. I presented the visual evidence for this. There are a lot of massive structures underwater where there should not be structures, which need to be explained. And I think if this work were taken up by a major oceanographic institute, I'm just a single individual, you know, with the resources of a single individual. But if we put public funding into this and the resources of a major oceanographic institute and really searched the coastlines down to a depth of 120 meters beneath the sea, I think that a whole episode of our past would begin once again to reveal itself. We also need to be looking under the Sahara Desert. The Sahara Desert is a desert today, but during the last ice age, it was green. It's in a way like another ocean where much is hidden from us. Very little archaeology has been done in the Sahara Desert, but I would suggest that if more archaeology were done there, we would also begin to discover the traces of a lost civilization. And lastly, the Amazon jungle. You know, this is considered to be a place of simple hunter-gatherer tribes today. But more and more evidence is coming out of the Amazon of a high civilization in the past that was present in that area. So all the places that we're not looking now, underwater, under the sands of the Sahara, in the depths of the Amazon jungle, those are the places where we're going to find the traces of the civilization that was largely wiped from the face of the earth in the great cataclysms at the end of the last ice age, more than 12,000 years ago.